Welcome. I'm Robert Dydel from the WKU History Department, and welcome today to a panel on John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry.
There we go.
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear now?
Just while I'm thinking of it, a bit of housekeeping. Those of you who want your card swiped to prove you've attended this wonderful event, at 11:15, I will take up a position at this doorway with the card swiper, but please be quiet and orderly as you rush me to get your card swipe. Today is, in fact, the 150th anniversary of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, an event which he hoped would spark the beginning of the end of slavery in the United States. And oddly enough, for an event that was seen as a military disaster and failure, Brown was successful in his larger goal, although in ways that he may not have imagined. Today we have two members of the History Department, Dr. Glenn LaFantasy and Dr. John Harden, to speak to us on aspects of Brown's raid. And I also, before I turn it over to them, I want to express special thanks to WKU Library for allowing us to host this event here and for being a co-sponsor of this panel. So, Glenn?
Oh, cell phone.
Oh, turn off your cell phone.
I've done that.
Thank you all for coming today, and the anniversary of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry is a strange and difficult, I think, kind of commemoration. Some people would say that this is a commemoration. Others would say perhaps that it's a celebration. It depends on one's point of view. I've also been to Harper's Ferry, where the raid occurred, a number of times in my life, and for a very long time, almost 20 years. I lived not very far, within an hour's drive of the place, so I tended to hang out there a bit more than my wife and children would have preferred. Nevertheless, most people do not think of Harper's Ferry, now West Virginia. At the time of the raid, it was in the Commonwealth of Virginia, as an American shrine. It is not like Valley Forge or the Alamo or even Ground Zero in New York. These places, most Americans would probably admit, are hallowed ground, plain and simple. Harper's Ferry is a beautiful place where some terrible history has taken place, but it doesn't qualify as sacred soil in the depths of our American soul. But even if Harper's Ferry cannot qualify it as a hallowed site, it has much to say about the American experience. Harper's Ferry National Historical Park and the surviving modern town adjacent to it are nestled in the deep shadows of the Blue Ridge Mountains on a sharp point of land that juts out between the Potomac and Shenandoah Rivers. History flows through Harper's Ferry, just as it does along the mighty currents of the two famous rivers that join together just below the town. There is no denying its physical beauty, which is as breathtaking today as it was in John Brown's day. Resting at the foot of the surrounding blue hills and massive stone cliffs, which create stunning contrasts of shade and light across the face of the town, Harper's Ferry is an absolute wonder to behold. But there is something quite unsettling about the place. The brooding ruins of old factories and the empty stone shells of dilapidated buildings, the endless force of the rivers and as they flow mightily or gently, depending on the season, by the town, the abundant signs of devastation caused by repeated floods over the years, the now silent landmarks associated with John Brown and his abortive raid on the armory and arsenal in 1859, and the tragic reminders of a town caught between contending armies in the Civil War, all of these things create an ominous tone, an atmosphere of gloom that the scenic splendor of Harper's Ferry cannot entirely offset. Perhaps it is because the town is so vulnerable to destruction, even today. In 1996, two floods, one in January and the other in September, inundated the lower town where most of the park's property is located, and more than 29 feet of water flooded into the town each time during these two floods. Since the town's founding, freshets have disturbed its tranquility and productivity. In the years before John Brown's raid, floods routinely interrupted work at the U.S. Armory, Arsenal, and Rifle Works. After the Civil War, high water continued to disrupt the town and the lives of its residents. An autumn flood in 1870 claimed 42 lives and caused incalculable damage. Nowadays, when the floods come and the waters finally recede, the National Park Service must close down the park and, in the aftermath of the rushing waters, take up the job once more of reconstructing buildings and exhibits that had previously been refurbished to perfection. Even with flood control upriver on the Potomac, there is no stopping the power of nature at Harper's Ferry. But the menacing feeling that always seems to be below the surface at Harper's Ferry goes beyond a human wariness of nature's unrelenting wrath. Underneath Harper's Ferry's Harper's Ferry's natural beauty and fury, there is the more disturbing fact that this small town, this otherwise quiet hamlet resting in the soft cradle of the Blue Ridge Mountains, has had a very violent history. It was John Brown who brought violence to Harper's Ferry nearly now 150 years ago today, and in so doing he changed the character and the significance of the place forever. My first impression of John Brown came in my youth when I saw this painting, what I considered a startling painting of him in the pages of American Heritage magazine. The original portrait, part of a huge mural painted by John Stuart Curry in the Kansas State Capitol, shows a wild, crazed man, wide-eyed and wind-blown, with arms outstretched. Behind him, a dark tornado sweeps across the Kansas plains. Brown's mouth is open and he is howling something, heaven knows what. I found the picture unnerving and downright frightening, which no doubt was Curry's intention. At the tender age of 10, I decided that Brown could not be included in my private pantheon of American heroes. Later, I began to struggle with that decision. In another issue of American Heritage, I came upon yet another painting of Brown, this one showing an entirely different fellow. The illustration is a famous one, painted by Thomas Hovenden, depicting Brown as he leaves the jailhouse in Charlestown, Virginia, on December 2nd, 1859, on his way to the gallows. As he descends some stairs, an African-American mother lifts her baby up towards him, and he, in response, leans over to kiss the child. This scene never actually happened. A New York Tribune reporter, taking a great deal of journalistic license, included the fictional baby kissing episode in a dispatch, and the story quickly became embedded in the John Brown legend. The contrasting pictures graphically demonstrate the two different John Browns that have come down to us since the time of his famous raid at Harper's Ferry and his execution by the Commonwealth of Virginia for treason in December 1859. During his own lifetime, some Americans, especially Southerners and pro-slavery sympathizers, called him crazy, a madman who had hoped to incite slave rebellions throughout the South. In our own day, Brown still stirs up controversy and sets people, especially historians, at odds with one another. Yet among one group of Americans, African Americans, there seems to be a consensus about John Brown that exists among no other segment of our society. For Black Americans, John Brown is a hero. And ever since his death, they have sustained their high opinion of him and have elevated him to a place occupied by few whites. When John Brown stretched forth his arm, the sky was cleared, wrote Frederick Douglass, the former slave who became an advocate for Black civil rights during and after the Civil War. He was, said Douglass, a just man and true. A century later, Malcolm X proclaimed to his fellow Blacks, John Brown was a white man who went to war against white people to help free slaves. And any white man who is ready and willing to shed blood for your freedom in the sight of other whites, he's nuts. John Brown has become the stuff of legend as well as history, and it is the legend more than anything else that captures our imagination and furnishes us with the two John Browns, one violent and villainous, one benevolent and heroic. There is, moreover, there is more to it than that, however. Legend or not, something deep down in our American soul truly shocks us about the man. Like the way that mural portrait of him as an avenging angel made my hair stand on end as a kid. John Brown disturbs us so much, so powerfully, that we want to explain him away as quickly as possible. A more famous photograph of him, this one here, taken in the spring of 1859 before the raid on Harper's Ferry, suggests why we feel so much uneasiness about him. Take one look into those eyes. There's fire in them, more than in the discomforting Curry painting, and his riveting eyes are something you can neither avoid nor ever forget. In that disquieting stare, something much clearer than his mental state is immediately evident. You can see this is a man of deadly purpose. D.H. Lawrence once wrote that the essential American soul is hard, isolate, stoic, and a killer. Indeed, a deep river of violence runs through the American experience, and it cannot be ignored or avoided. Not every American, to be sure, fits Lawrence's brutal description, but there is a strain in all of us that lets us denounce the violence that besets our society while we passively tolerate it. To a great extent, our own ambivalence is a lot like what one sees and senses in modern Harper's Ferry. To the naked eye, all is serene and resplendent. Beneath it all, there's that disquieting feeling of doom. The reality of nature's violence lives in Harper's Ferry, and so does the legacy of human violence. With the zeal of a true believer, for he was convinced that God ordered and condoned his actions, John Brown took up the sword and used it ruthlessly and bloodily. And it must be said, without giving much contemplation to what he was doing or to the malevolence he was spreading. His violence seemed almost instinctive and reflexive, like the violence that leads troubled souls to shoot random victims in a shopping mall or on a college campus. John Brown was convinced that his righteous cause justified his violent means, just as religious terrorists down through time and now, in our own uneasy age, have shed blood in the name of their gods and prophets. Perhaps that is why many Americans, in the wake of the Harper's Ferry raid, believed Brown was insane. A good number of historians have also argued that Brown must have been crazy, or at the very least, chronically depressed or a manic depressive. But in doing so, they miss a vital point beyond Malcolm X's discerning comment about why whites think Brown was nuts. Brown's use of violence in the sectional controversy over slavery may have been abhorrent, but it was not necessarily aberrant. Like H. Rapp Brown, another African-American militant of the 1960s, John Brown knew that violence was as American as cherry pie. But we would prefer to think that Brown was insane or bipolar or maybe emotionally challenged, because it is far too horrifying to acknowledge that Brown sprang from a long tradition of American violence and that he was, in so many respects, a product of the American soul. Americans tend to deny that violence is in our soul, for though we understand that much of our past has been filled with violence and that much of our present is torn apart by violence, we find it very difficult to face up to the fact that we are, in the end, a very violent people, and that aggression may be found at the very core of our experience as a people and as a nation. We think of ourselves as an eminently peaceful people. We deny that D.H. Lawrence looked with any kind of clarity into our soul. As Richard Hofstadter, the historian, puts it, what is most exceptional about the Americans is not the voluminous record of their violence, but their extraordinary ability in the face of that record to persuade themselves that they are among the best behaved and best regulated of peoples. John Brown attracts us and repels us at the same time. But what we are most reluctant to admit is that his actions, and particularly his violent deeds, were and are quintessentially American. In that sense, then, what we cannot face is that John Brown is not an aberration. What we truly cannot face is that John Brown is us. Thank you.
Dr. Harden?
Here comes the good part. What I'd like to do now is to give a different perspective. Professor LaFantasy mentioned that African Americans have a perspective, and some of this is mine, some of this is a little bit of all of those things together. So what I'm going to do is, for just a few minutes, mine will be a little bit briefer. The celebration of John Brown's December 2nd, 1859 death in black communities became at that time an example of one white man's personal commitment to end slavery. One could argue that black communities interested in the abolition of slavery supported Brown's use of the very core of slavery's existence, that is, the use of violence and terror. American slaveholders, including a few black ones, perceived their mission to civilize the African population by using rape of women and children, as well as the mutilation of men, women, and children. These behaviors by slaveholders were not not nonviolent. They and were acceptable behaviors by church-going and, more than not, most non-church-going slaveholders. From the 1640s forward, American slaveholders struggled to justify and often legislated violence as statutory punishments in colonial and eventually in state legislatures. Into this picture, we see John Brown and his followers seeking to take a drastic effort to destroy an institution justified by three articles in the United States Constitution. That is Article 1, Section 2, which supports what's called the Three-Fifths Clause, Article 1, Section 9, Extension of Slave Trade, and Article 4, Section 2, the Fugitive Slave Law. And slavery was also justified by the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Sanford versus Dred Scott. Simply put, Brown was no longer trying to gently and nonviolently persuade change of slavery that was not going to and refused to change. Simply, slaveholders said, we won't change, we're very legal in what we're doing, and we're going to do that. Brown's behaviors also reflected a broader societal acceptance of violent measures to control their property's behavior. Slaveholders would use an arsenal of tools. They would use whips, dirks, a dirk is like a billy club, coffles, shackles, and other restraints to control impudent and uncontrollable blacks. Slave rebel Nat Turner, 1831 violent attack in Virginia, during which 60 whites were killed by him and a small band of black followers, demonstrated this sense of hopelessness in trying to end this barbaric system by persuasion. Although Turner used a similar sort of apocalyptic, Armageddon-like solution of murder and mayhem, Turner's efforts assumed that thousands of Virginia blacks would somehow rise up with him and force their masters to end the system at once. However, Turner's efforts were summarized and packaged by white attorney Thomas Gray, who interviewed him in a work called Confessions of Nat Turner, which left an impression that the man was clearly possessed with a demon and highly dysfunctional. Free blacks came under suspicion of acting like Turner and were forced to leave some southern states or post bond that they would not cause violence against slaveholders. As abolitionists became more vocal in the early 19th century, but essentially ineffective, Brown took a different approach in how he hoped to accomplish his attack and ultimately destruction of the system of slavery. Initially, he would attack that federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, so eloquently described by my colleague here, a small town, but it had become a place where guns and weapons were manufactured. And again, his premise was that the United States government was the protector, defender, and supporter of the slavery institution. Afterwards, he would capture the town, take the 100,000 weapons produced there, and then turn them against the very forces that protected it. Next, Brown, as did other violent attackers on the system, assumed that thousands of black and white volunteers would somehow attack the system and destroy it. In May 1858, Brown and his family members, including his sons and others, as well as friends, met in Chatham, Ontario, with in the group some 34 blacks, including some of the following people we're going to see here. Let me just sort of go forth. Ah, I didn't have him. I thought I had Osborne Perry Anderson. So let me just back up a little bit. Osborne Perry Anderson, eventually the sole black survivor of the Harper's Ferry event. Four other blacks, Shields Green, right here, who was the only former slave in the group, Dangerfield Newby, who was of mixed race, and where is he? There he is, John Copeland, another mixed race person, along with Lewis Leary. I had him out of order. Lewis Leary. These four would join the band of 19 attackers. Were their efforts in this attack immediately successful? As with such events, the answer is no. For one, the ammunition that this group carried in their guns was the wrong type for the muskets produced by the arsenal of Harper's Ferry. There was also an expectation that reinforcements by others from Canada, who said they were going to come, and with support from Harriet Tubman, were supposed to arrive. They never arrived. And there was the assumption that local blacks in the region would simply sort of rise up and join with them. Okay, what is the body count, so to speak? 10 members of the group were immediately killed in the fighting, which lasted about a day and a half, including Newby and Leary, and two of Brown's sons. 7 others, including blacks Copeland, Green, and Brown himself, were captured after several weeks. And again, what we mean by this is they really don't have a successful event. All were tried for treason, found guilty, and sentenced for execution by hanging. Brown was to be executed on December 2, 1859, but out of public view. The black co-conspirators were to be executed 2 weeks after Brown. Even in death, there was sort of segregation. When word of this event got out, black churches held fundraisers for the soon-to-be widows of the conspirators. And again, one of them is going to be a college student. We'll talk about that in a minute. So black churches and other groups said, look, these people are going to die. Brown's execution day, December 2nd, was declared, quote, Martyr Day, unquote, by black abolitionists. Special prayer services were held at other black churches all across the country. In Chatham, Ontario, special prayer services were held at the time of Brown's execution. Black businesses closed as well. Following his execution, his body was conveyed to North Elba in New York, and again, it would become, in a sense, later on, most of the bodies, except four of them, would be transferred, exhumed later, and buried with Brown. Much later, not at this particular point in 1859. Now, while Brown was the center of the event, one of the condemned men, let me just see if I can get to it, there we go, John A. Copeland, was from North Carolina. He was married, had a child, and was an Oberlin College student. According to his last comments, he remarked, "If I am dying for freedom, I could not die for a better cause." The December 17, 1859 New York Tribune reported that Copeland and Shields Green, quote, "mounted the scaffold with a firm step," unquote. As each of the Brown Party died, they became larger in life and far more successful than they ever anticipated. Memorials were made of Brown and the group's heroic stand as they were executed. A popular song among abolitionists was, "John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave." Its melody would be sung later and infused into something called the Battle Hymn of the Republic. "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming." Okay, familiar with it. Bad rendition. Commanders of the U.S. Marines, sent by President Buchanan, sent to stop this terrorist act would be Colonel Robert E. Lee and Lieutenant J.E.B. Stuart, Jeb Stuart. Both men would be convinced of the necessity to stop not only Brown, but any others willing to destroy Southern culture. Later, the military skills of both men would become very essential to the Confederacy. Abolitionists who were committed to a gradual dissolution of slavery using moral suasion of white slave owners found themselves becoming a small minority. Brown and his interracial band felt that they had no other realistic alternative. Death was no longer a deterrent to immediatist abolitionists, that is, abolitionists who said you had to end slavery now. Death was no longer a deterrent, whether they were white or black. The Southern slaveholding states ordered ammunition for their own state arsenals and began drilling what were called well-armed militias. Psychologically, John Brown had become a white version of Nat Turner, Gabriel Prosser, and Denmark Vesey, all of whom were blacks who planned and or initiated failed attacks on slavery in earlier decades. While these more well-known attacks unnerved slaveholders, these attacks represented some of the 250-plus slave rebellions in the United States in the period of chattel slavery. Even before the seven Brown conspirators were executed, it is said two blacks in nearby Berryville, Virginia, were convicted of arson and sentenced to death on the grounds that their acts were the result of the Brown attack. After some persuasion by local whites that these slaves were local and they were not foreigners, as were the Brownites, their sentences were commuted to life imprisonment at hard labor. Kentucky historian J. Winston Coleman would write that a Cynthiana panic occurred in November 1859 as another spinoff of this event. So it wasn't just in Virginia. It was across all of the slaveholding states. All right. Now here comes the last paragraph, which is always good. In summary, my comments today suggest that Brown and his interracial band of conspirators were perhaps on a suicide mission. Yet to cooperate with that system in any way made them collaborators with the same evil. Free blacks, especially those born free and possibly carried into slavery, which a number were, reached the conclusion that unless all were free, no blacks were free. Apparently, Brown reached another conclusion. Unless whites ended slavery of blacks, enslavement of whites by slavery's depravity and moral turpitude would continue. To use a saying in an old comic strip by the name of Pogo, those of you that are about my age know who Pogo is, he makes a comment at one point in a strip and he says, "We have met the enemy and he is us." Thank you.
I would just like to add a few comments and then we'll open up to questions. The one thing I guess I would like to stress is the religious element to both Brown's vision of America and to his use of violence in trying to achieve that vision, which I think is also fairly American if you look at our history. Brown did believe that he was an instrument of God, but that doesn't mean he heard voices. God spoke to him through the scriptures that he read, and he spoke to God through his prayers, but he didn't hallucinate sort of figures or voices in his mind. And in those scriptures, we know certain passages he took very seriously because he marked them. And I'll just share two of them with you. One is from Hebrews 13:3. Remember them that are in bonds as bound with them, and them which suffer adversity as being yourselves also in the body. Brown took that seriously. He felt, as Dr. Harden has just pointed out, if there was a slave in America, then he was enslaved. All shared in that state of bondage. Another more ominous is from Exodus 21:16. And he that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. Now, until I read about Brown recently, I thought I'd known the Bible fairly well, but I'd realized that abolitionists often referred to slavery as man-stealing in the 19th century. And clearly this is the source of it. And Brown saw this as an egregious sin. As a religious figure, he also took upon himself the role of a prophet. And I'd like to end with sharing a note that he passed on his way to the scaffold. He passed one of his jailers, which if you're familiar with Lincoln's second inaugural address, you might be able to call the passage that echoes the same sentiment. It says, "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. I had, as I now think vainly, flattered myself without very much bloodshed, it might be done." So clearly he foresaw the catastrophe that was looming in our nation's history. So let's open it up to questions or comments.
Are the things that were said by these two gentlemen going to be posted on a website so where we can read what they were saying?
The text, I don't know if we'll post those, but the audio file will be posted. We're recording it, and so it will be available on the History Department website.
I'm going to post the text today on my own website, for which any contribution is www.glennlefantasy is one word .com.
LeFantasy.
LaFantasy. Glenn with two N's.
And what I can do is send a copy of mine to Glenn, so if you pull up his, that way you just go to one website with it. The recording of this is called the History Department. The recording goes to the History Department Workday site. Right now that's available only to the faculty because we have other documents there. But if your professor has a Blackboard site, I can make the file available to him, then he can pull it up. But it is being recorded digitally so we can have this as something that people can use in other ways. So let me know if you're a professor. Is everyone in here from classes? If you're not from a class, just let me know. We'll make arrangements so you can get to hear it if you want to hear it again.
Yeah. Can you call it the Hovenden Portrait?
Yeah. Hang on a sec. The Hovenden Portrait, yeah.
Yeah. Way in the back first and then.
How big a force is he facing and exactly who were they?
How big a force?
I believe it was about 1,000. They sent, about 1,000 Marines? There were Marines?
No, it was 85, I thought, Marines.
Yeah, there weren't that many. He had a band of, in total, there were 22 men, including himself.
Yeah.
Some of them were left behind at a house in Maryland to guard the arms they had stored there. Then others in the party got separated in Harpers Ferry itself. John Brown took refuge, John Brown, some of his followers, and he had taken hostages as well, including the great-grandnephew of George Washington, a fellow by the name of Lewis Washington. Brown and his band, or what remained of it, took refuge in a fire engine house on the grounds of the armory. And what historians have struggled with is that once townspeople began to react, the cry of insurrection was yelled through the streets of Harpers Ferry, and the local militia did form, and shots were fired. Brown was presumably trapped in this engine house, but he could have, given the amount of firepower he had, sharps, breech-loading, repeating rifles in his possession, he could have made his escape by either one of two bridges. But he remained instead in the engine house, inevitably leading to a siege situation and to his inevitable capture when the townspeople closed off those bridges. But he had had ample opportunity to leave. That suggests to many historians that the scenario here may not have actually been a realistic one in terms of him inciting a slave rebellion. Instead, he, as Dr. Hardin pointed out, and his men may have truly been on a suicide mission, that they realized they were going to be captured, that they did this to attract attention, and that Brown himself, during the period in which he was jailed, he took a very high stand, and as a martyr, he was very cognizant of the fact that he was going to become a martyr. And as one historian has put it, he put spin on his own story, and spin as we know it. The engine house, what led to his capture was the engine house was raided by these U.S. Marines that came under the command of Robert E. Lee, who was an Army colonel, not a Marine colonel. Right. It tells you something about the size of the U.S. military in 1859 that they could only round up about 85 Marines stationed in the town, but no officer for the Marines. They had to go to and find this Army colonel who was on leave at the time, Robert E. Lee, and they also rounded up Jeb Stuart, Lieutenant Jeb Stuart. Stuart approached the engine house with a note from Lee and also a plea to John Brown that he and his men give up and release their hostages. Brown refused. Jeb Stuart then stepped aside from the door of the engine house, waved his hat, and the Marines came forward carrying a huge ladder, and the ladder, almost instantaneously used as a battering ram, broke open the doors of the engine house. The Marines rushed in. Brown was wounded with a head wound from a sword, although the Marine who wounded him only had his dress sword, a very flimsy little sword, so the sword bent as the Marine tried to stab John Brown, but it did inflict a minor head wound. Two of Brown's sons were killed. The hostages were safe. But those are the numbers. That's a very long answer to the numbers involved in this, which was a very small affair that had a very large impact throughout the nation.
I was just going to, there's one more little piece of trivia. The first person killed in the whole event was a free black who was on the, I think it was the railroad?
Station platform, yeah.
Station platform. And, you know, they didn't want the word to get out exactly then, so he's the first one to die. A free black is killed by their group. So you sort of scratch your head and said, this, it started out downhill and kept going faster and faster. And so again, when you look at the numbers, it becomes, I think, bigger after the event's over with than the actual conflict itself. It's the premise of why it was done. That's the scary thing to so many people.
Okay. You had a question?
Well, my question kind of became encompassed in that last one, but I guess just in case there's some shade to it, it was, did they have a particular strategy to get from this particular incident to the greater goal, or was that
or was that strategy based in a form of martyrdom and the way that it kind of worked out? That was
I think it was a pretty hazy strategy. When Brown said that the intent was to capture the armory and arsenal, load up this great storehouse of weapons, they had come to Harper's Ferry with this rickety buckboard wagon that was not about to carry 100,000 muskets in the back of it. So it would seem that Brown was not stupid, although some historians have claimed that he must have been, but nevertheless, he was not a stupid man. If he truly intended to take away 100,000 muskets, then either he did expect the local slaves to rise up, come to Harper's Ferry, and carry those muskets themselves, but he also must have known that in the area of Harper's Ferry, now West Virginia, but at that time Virginia, a slaveholding state, there were very few slaves, in fact. It's one of the reasons why later West Virginia breaks away, secedes during the Civil War from the Commonwealth of Virginia, and becomes the state of West Virginia in 1863, was that that portion of Virginia did not have a very large slave population, nor did the white people who lived there identify very much with Tidewater slave planters in eastern Virginia. So it would seem that Brown must have known all of this information. He picked Harper's very, very carefully. He must have known he was not going to be able to carry those weapons away. I think the once again, I would agree with those historians who see his intent as making himself a martyr for the cause of abolition, but for the cause of radical abolition, the use of violence as a means toward an end.
Dean Lee, you have a question.
What do we know about the origins of this ideal of John Brown? Do we have some sense of when it begins to develop in his mind? Was it suggested to him, either perhaps indirectly in some way? Where did this whole idea come from?
That's one of the big imponderables among historians, is that it would be lovely if there were a catalyst, some single event that took place. But John Brown's record is actually spotty. He claimed to have been an opponent to slavery all his life. And there are those moments very early on from the 1830s where he committed himself to the struggle against slavery. But then those very long periods in life when he was totally uninvolved in any effort, any abolitionist effort or anti-slavery effort, and was focusing, as most of us do, on our daily affairs and doing business. In Brown's case, unfortunately for him and his very large family, he was a business failure over and over again, whether it was farming or raising sheep or selling wool or whatever it turned out to be. But sometime before 1856, three of his sons go to Kansas, which by that time had already erupted into a mini civil war over whether Kansas territory would be a slave territory or a free territory. Brown decided at that point to answer his son's appeal that he bring some weapons with him to help them out in their fight to make Kansas free, in their fight against Missouri border ruffians that had crossed over into Kansas and were part of the opposition to the anti-slavery forces there. That seems to have been a huge turning point for him, because events from that time, from May of 1856, when Brown and a small group of his men and sons ended up murdering in the dead of night five who they thought were pro-slavery proponents. From that moment in May 1856 to October 1859, Brown seems to have embraced violence. The strategy for Harper's Ferry seems to have been his own. I think, as Dr. Hardin suggested, that Brown saw Nat Turner, And Nat Turner's Rebellion of the early 1830s is inspirational, but historians don't have hard evidence of that fact. But I still think that Turner's Rebellion was such a major event in 1831. Brown knew about it, and I feel he must have been inspired by this to at least come up with the idea for this slave rebellion that he would incite. Ultimately, though, I think the plans for martyrdom, for this suicide mission, as Dr. Hardin put it, overtook, because I think he realized that it was unrealistic to expect thousands and thousands of slaves to rise up against their owners.
One last question.
Actually, I just have a comment. You know, since everyone else has said that piece about the man, I'd like to voice my opinion on it. A lot of people want to say he was crazy or whatever. And just like you said, no one has any hard evidence about what really inspired him to do the things he did after being so absent in the fight of an abolitionist perception of the world, of the country at that time. But, I mean, like you said, the man, he was a businessman. He had a big family to take care of. There's no way, if you're a real man and you want to support your family, you can fight for someone else your entire life. So, you know, I feel like that's kind of thrown out of the perception of who John Brown really was. And you see it in his own sons when they do go to Kansas and they're in the so-called Civil War of Kansas. If he can inspire his own grown sons on their lives to, you know, fight for other people, and then he stands up to the call of duty, and goes to Kansas himself, I wouldn't view him as someone who's insane or like so many other historians do. I would view him as someone who was willing to die for a greater cause. Because, truth be told, if John Brown was a senator, he'd be Abraham Lincoln. You know, basically, Abraham Lincoln, he had this thing called the Emancipation Proclamation that just so happened to have a war with it, you know. If John Brown would have had some kind of proclamation and had some other senators back him up, you know, and he didn't die, we wouldn't be having this discussion today. So that's just my perception of who it was, coming from a, you know, a younger black man.
And just to add to that, I think it should be emphasized that Brown came from a family that was staunchly anti-slavery, and also opposed what they called negrophobia in the North. They were well aware of the prejudice, race prejudice in the North as well, and they fought that. But it's just that Brown moves into violence, whereas his father, Owen, for instance, spent his entire life fighting slavery and racial prejudice against Native Americans as well as African Americans, but had always restrained himself, saying, well, I'm not going to cross that line into violence.
I also want to add, I didn't mean to suggest at all that Brown lacked commitment to the cause. And I was just simply recalling how day-to-day life did consume part of him for a time. That's not meant as a derogatory statement in any way. It's just that he couldn't spend all of his time on the anti-slavery efforts. And indeed, John Brown's commitment certainly went farther than any other white man, because he did indeed give his life, and he very knowingly gave his life for the sake of freeing slaves and ending slavery. I mean, that's a huge, huge act in his life, conscious act in his life. So, talking about commitment, I can't think of any greater commitment that a human being can make than to do such a thing. And he did it consciously, he did it willingly, so it's completely understandable why this duality of him exists. We might be repelled, as I argued, by his violent means, but there's a part of him that is so appealing as a hero, because of the stand that he took.
Okay, now I know that some of you have classes to go to, so you know, those of you who want to stay and continue the discussion with the panelists, feel free to do so. I'm going to go out in this hallway out here to swipe cards.
There is a website called wvculture.org. for the West Virginia Archives, wbculture.org, which has an excellent website with all this information, a lot of information on John Brown and the celebration. Thank you.
Anyway, I miss a lot of stuff and writing notes and stuff. That's a good way to...
Yep.